hosts, Maya Monell and Aaron Papworth, founders of the Navit Money app, the money management app that uses behavioral science to foster financial wellness. Today, Aaron and I sat down with Dr. Carly Urban, a professor of economics focusing on financial security and literacy at the state and federal level. She's focused on creating a comprehensive financial curriculum for high school age students. In today's episode, we cover the socioeconomic barriers to financial literacy and why we all feel less than prepared by the time we graduate. Dr. Carly Urban, thank you so much for joining Aaron and I for another episode of the Navit podcast. We're so excited to dive into this topic with you today. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, I can't wait. So we're going to dive into a lot around financial literacy and frankly, the lack of literacy we might have all experienced during our high school and more formidable years. But first, I'd love for you to tell us a little bit more about your background, why you got into this topic. You're in Montana. It seems like a beautiful place to be outdoors and not teaching, you know, teaching and researching financial literacy. So why do you do what you do?
Totally. So I'm actually from the East Coast. I was born in Jersey and I grew up in Pennsylvania my entire life. So I haven't always lived in a beautiful, like mountainous, gorgeous location. So I didn't start there. I am trained as an economist. So I actually have my PhD in economics from the University of Wisconsin. And at that time, really the only reason I got into financial literacy was because I was looking at two different research papers probably in 2012, 2013. And both of them were on state mandated financial education. And they both had this initial table that said which states required personal finance and when, and none of the states matched. And these are like two really prominent researchers, really smart people. And I was like, there has to be more to this than just like one of these guys is right and the other side is wrong. So I kind of spent a lot of time thinking about like why these might be off. And I wrote a grant to the FINRA Foundation and said like, hey, I'm going to get to the bottom of this. I'm going to understand what state financial education policy is in high schools. And then that's kind of where it started. And then once you kind of figure out the devil's in the details, you just like keep digging further and keep learning more. And I'm like the type of economist that loves institutional details. So I love figuring out actually what's happening on the ground and where and why and when. So I think that kind of was just like a well-suited area to me. I think people always want me to have like a sob story. Like I got into financial trouble when I was 19 and that's why like this is my life mission, but I'm totally lame in every other capacity of this.
Well, that's okay. Aww. So are we. So I mean, I think everybody expects us as founders to have a sob story too, but, no, I think that also like drives your passion for it because if you've had a positive experience in whatever your background was with finances, then that can also drive you to help others have a better experience with it too, because we definitely know that there's a lack of literacy and access to educational opportunity in the country. So we're super excited to dive in.
But I want to know what, I want to know what the end result was of those two studies. Like who was right?
Yeah. So like many things, it was somewhere in between. And actually, it was even more dismal than either of them, I would say. Maybe in a lot of cases, they were both wrong. So they were really saying like personal finance education in high school was like requiring anything. Literally one person could talk about interest rates one day and that would check the box in any course curriculum in K-12. And not surprisingly, like that doesn't really have an effect, right? So in the 1970s, when one person talked about interest rates for one day and sometime in K-12 curriculum, there's no change in behavior when you're age 50, like shocker, right? But now, like post 2000, there's a lot of states that actually require some level of personal finance content before graduation. And so my way of going about it was a little bit more systematic, where I collected all the graduation requirements from every state from 1970 to present. And I was able to see what was in all of the graduation requirements. And that was like at least a systematic way to say what was actually required to get a high school diploma in each of these states and every year.
Also, that data is incredible. Like, where did you get it?
lots of phone calls, a full team of RAs, lots of emails. State departments of education were really helpful, surprisingly. Maybe not surprisingly, but they're pretty strapped. So I thought that like this one additional ask might be too much. And every time they change the graduation requirements, they have to record it. So we got them all.
That's so interesting. And I remember reading a statistic that, and I could be totally wrong now, but like 1/3 of the country has some, like, or 1/3 of all states have some kind of curriculum in place. But, and we're going to dive into this in a minute of like what that curriculum looks like, but also, I'm curious to know, like, are we talking about a structured class? Like you walk into a class, you have a teacher that's solely devoted to that topic, or is this happening in like science at the last 10 minutes of that period or something?
So there are 5 states right now as of the 2020 graduating cohort that require a standalone personal finance class to be completed. And that Utah, Missouri, Tennessee, Virginia, and Alabama. I'm going to mess up Alabama or Arkansas. One of the two is passing this year, is starting this year. So we'll lump them both in. But in those states, every school actually has that requirement on the books. We actually last year went through all the course catalogs in all these states and the high schools just to see what was actually happening on the ground. Thanks to Next Gen Personal Finance for funding that. But we looked at all these course catalogs, and in those states, every school has it on the books. Now there's another about 20, 22 states, depending on whether or not you're including the next coming year, that require it to be taught within something else. Some of them have very specific requirements, say like, hey, this has to be within economics, or this has to be within social studies, or this has to be within anything, right? So it varies quite a bit. I think in Ohio, they recommend putting it in American government, which is kind of odd, but that's where it is. And in those states, when we looked at those course catalogs, only about 1/3 had something required. So it seems like it's easier to kind of skirt past that and not actually adhere to the state policy. But I mean, you can't blame the schools. They're underfunded. Most of these are totally unfunded, and the state just says, do this, and here's no money to train the teachers or to do anything else. So it's a little bit trickier.
I think it's so fascinating. And we're going to dive into some of those barriers. But first off, I think everybody would like to learn a little bit more about, you know, what are some of the key topics covered in a financial literacy course in high school? I mean, what have we all missed out on?
Yeah, totally. So I think some of the big things, big overarching things, are just like learning how to budget, learning what potential careers you might have and what your monthly income will look like. And then once you're kind of understanding what that side of the balance sheet will look like, then you can start to understand long run debt and understand what those payments will look like, right? And I think it's really important to teach that in a very inclusive way, since I know a lot of states have been pushing more student loan curriculum directly, but there's a lot of people who don't go to college, right? So you have to make that relevant to people, to this population, who likely will earn less after they graduate from high school without any additional training, and will have to manage more potential shocks and maybe have more emergency savings or something, some other ways. But understanding that long run debt has to come in the context of like auto loans or maybe even mortgages, as well as student loans. So not just making it like a very specific tailored curriculum just to some people. And then I think once you're understanding the long run debt and interest rates, then you can start to understand the credit scores, right? Like how your rates actually get priced, and understanding how to use credit cards responsibly and how much interest that can rack up. Some also directly talk about payday lending and other high cost borrowing options.
I think it's so interesting. Are there any, of course, I'm going to go off topic a little bit, not really, but is there any research being done right now or that has been done in the past that tries to correlate the kids, taking the population of kids that get some level and maybe the better curriculum around financial literacy, correlating that to like career outcomes and income access later down the line?
Yeah. So a lot of my research specifically has looked at like these state policies and how they affect long run outcomes. So things like credit scores improve, delinquencies fall, non-student debt falls, student loan borrowers become more savvy. So they actually move from higher interest like credit card borrowing to more Stafford loans, which are really low interest and don't accrue interest while you're in school. There's also some findings by Melody Harvey that show that payday lending goes down, especially among young people. And Daniel Mangrum has also shown that student loan repayment goes up. Now, what you're talking about is, does it actually change income or does it change other stuff? What financial education doesn't change is, first, whether or not you go to college, doesn't move that at all. Where you go to college doesn't move at all. Whether or not you go to a more or less expensive college, in or out of state, part-time, full-time, literally nothing on the post-secondary education attainment scale. We've done some research to look at income more recently, and we see nothing there either. So it doesn't actually change how much you make. And I think in some ways, your preferences and your skill sets are fixed. And maybe in the long run, if you try to pick something that is more fruitful income-wise, it might just not work out because it's not a good fit for you and you're absolutely miserable. I think about like my husband who, you know, went to school for engineering and was an engineer for a long time and was like, I hate engineering. Like 6 years later, like, this is awful. I'm working on really interesting projects. He was in the he's in the bike industry, actually, like designing like Tour de France bikes. And he was like, I just hate engineering so much, right? So you pick that job thinking about this future income. And he's like, maybe I want to be an EMT or a ski patroller or something else. And right, that's not like, maybe like you can move a needle on what people do, but actually like, do you want to try to encourage people to just chase money? And as an economist who believes in like utility,
this is like exactly the core of Navid's kind of our perspective about financial literacy is that everyone has their own path. You all have, every single person has something individual to contribute to the world, and they have to find that on their own, whether that's with a GED, with just a high school education, or with a, you know, whatever that is your path to pursue, and income will come with it. The key is that when you get that income, no matter what the, you know, amount is, you know how to manage it in a healthy way, and you understand the way the system works that you are functioning in. Like for me, that, and so all those positive outcomes that you list should be the right outcomes for financial literacy. They should be, you know, lower student loan debt, better interest rate accumulation, like understanding the way you can get screwed in this system and preventing that, regardless of your income.
I have a question too. Has there been any research around private school, high school level financial literacy? And let's just call it socioeconomic outcome, but really it's income level.
Okay, so this is interesting. So I've, again, spent the last year looking at course catalogs, thanks Next Gen Personal Finance. And
what else do you do during COVID?
He's awesome, and he's been so helpful in kind of like pushing the research forward and really seeing what's out there and kind of letting me go crazy with local data, which you don't usually get to do. Not many people are this much of a data geek, right? But we looked at like what correlated with where personal finance courses are. Where is it required? Where is it required within another class? Where is it offered? And where is there absolutely nothing? And at first, there looks like there's this correlation with socioeconomic status. So higher poverty areas look like they have less personal finance requirements and offerings. But actually, when you dive down deeper into that, it's really just urban areas versus rural. So if you compare within an urban area, the high poverty and low poverty schools are equally likely to have it. Once you kind of condition on that, there's no difference. So I was shocked. There's no difference across race. There's no difference across like really kind of poverty income. It's actually areas with higher house prices because they're urban areas that are less likely to have personal finance. So it kind of, there's no clear correlates on the economic side, in terms of like, like demographic or economic characteristics of the school. Not surprisingly, better funded schools, right? Schools with higher teacher per pupil ratios, student teacher ratios, are more likely to have requirements. So you have more teachers around to do the actual course. Shockingly, they have it. Schools are underfunded. We know this, right? Nothing is rocket science there. So, yeah.
It's interesting.
It's a matter of having the resources that you expect to have.
I told my my boomer-aged mother that we are having you on the show, because I saw her this morning, and she said, well, you know, I have a theory around this. And I was like, I did not. Tell me. Her theory is that financial literacy went away from curriculum at large when we devalued home ec. And we got rid of home ec because of all the gender stereotypes to home ec. Oh, and so I have no basis for this, this hypothesis, but what do you think? I mean, supposedly, yeah, even in a lack of access to credit era of our, you know, our mothers, they had some level of financial literacy in their early school days.
I think that's not wrong. I think if we go back to what we were talking about earlier with, like, what did the quote unquote mandates look like early on in the 70s and 80s, usually that would be something in home ec, like writing a check, right? Learning how to balance a checkbook or something pretty basic that wouldn't necessarily be like an intensive learning about your finances in the way that we're talking about it now. It was definitely not required. So every teacher could kind of decide on what to emphasize or not emphasize in that kind of consumer science life. And I'm not sure if it like was, I wouldn't even call it the same kind of personal finance education we have now. I think it took until, you know, excluding four states that moved early on this, until like really early 2000s that anyone did like a rigorous, like, this is what we're going to teach. These are the important topics, and this is how we're going to implement it. Before we
but
really
it sounds
got
like they haven't
there.
Even, and they haven't even done that. Like, it's still not rigorous. It's still not universal. It's still state by state, right? It's kind of incredible.
So I mean, like, the state specific policies, right? So some states actually write out in their graduation requirements, you will cover these seven different topics, most of which are the ones that we've discussed, like understanding debt and credit scores and credit cards and budgets. But yeah, the implementation is messy, right? If you think about the implementation of any kind of educational reform, it's not perfect.
Oh my God. Not in this, especially in this country with state rights.
Yes. And seriously. Local rights, right? Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
So, why hasn't financial literacy been a key subject matter for high school students across different states?
So I think anytime you're thinking about high school curricula, it's super crowded. Kids are overextended. Every school board is fighting for something else. I think in some areas it's the arts. In some areas it's more sex ed to kind of curb teenage fertility rates, or there's always something else on the docket, even if it's just another free period for students. Like, they need a little bit of a break. There's always going to be people fighting for different classes. So I think you always have to make this ROI case and just say, like, yeah, personal finance seems intuitive as something that's really important for society as a whole. But you need to actually document it, right? If you're not showing that it's effective, then that's tricky. Right. And there was an early meta-analysis in 2014 that came out saying, we're looking at all these different studies and we're finding financial education doesn't work. I'll say only one of those papers that they included in this meta-analysis with hundreds of studies actually looked at youth. And I believe it was in a developing country. So again, devil's usually in the details of policy, right? So it's tricky. And we have since, I along with co-authors have since updated that meta-analysis, looked at lots of experiments, and the findings actually reversed. A lot of the research has really taken off since then, and it's positive, right? But when you have a big study like that that comes out, and you're pairing that with, you know, this crowded space where there's not a lot of room for additional curriculum, then what do, right? It's an uphill battle.
And so what are some of the, I mean, you spoke a little bit to some of the critics, but like, what are some of those barriers to trying to get, other than an overload of courses? Like, who are the people that are saying, you know, this is something that doesn't need to be prioritized, and how can we combat some of those arguments? Like, what's the research to show the opposite?
Okay. So the some of the other kind of opposing forces. So in ex ante, it seems like this should be something with bipartisan support. Everyone should want to improve the financial capability of Americans. Like, this should be straightforward. Right. Yeah. But I mean, there's the people who are like, okay, well, you know, schools are crowded. We don't want to fund this. There's not enough funding in schools already. Then there's the parents that are highly affluent that are like, I don't want to waste my kids' time. I can teach them this. Right. And that could be the case, right? If you have a really affluent parent who understands money management, they can probably teach you everything you need to know. But everyone is not lucky. We can't pick our parents. And like that affluent parent wants their kid to be taking all AP classes. They don't want to crowd their kid's schedule at all. And that's the parent that's often crying to the school board and right. lobbying against.
But then why don't... Then why don't we just try and implement, and I could see the counter case for this too, but why don't we try and implement some of this education in those AP classes? Like if we're talking AP econ at the high school level, surely this would be an obvious topic that resonates with your student pop.
That even yeah, you can get into those complicated things like investing and diversification yeah. and all the things, like what you were just saying are really the basics, like debt and budgeting. Right. But that's so it's really not teaching people about wealth generation. Right. So, I mean, I do understand that those people have influence and those are parents that think they can do it on their own. But yes, it's a bigger societal question.
I agree with you completely. And if anyone out there wants to start an AP course, push the college board to start an AP personal finance or finance class, I think that would be amazing. I would love to see that going forward.
Innovators. You can measure it.
Yeah. I mean, and I think that speaks to like the value of, we're talking about high school level for a reason. So Carly, why, you know, just briefly, but like why are high schoolers the prime age for this kind of content?
I think high schoolers are just getting their financial independence and they have a lot of big decisions to come up about long run debt situations that are going to affect them for the rest of their lives. And they really have this like unique position to set themselves up either for a success or a more difficult, challenging road. And if you make the wrong mistakes early on in life and, you know, rack up a bunch of credit card debt or start in one of these debt cycles early on, with payday loans, then it's going to be harder to break that. And if, to the extent that we can set them up in a better situation, I think that is super important. And kind of like looping back, another reason that people are against financial education is because they think about it as the blame game, right? People yeah. should have known better, oh, right? And yes. they oh. should have done this or they wouldn't have gotten into trouble. And I worry so much, especially given the current pandemic situation, that even talking about financial education just allows people to argue against a safety net. For, you know, like people who may have gotten into trouble early on or had a bunch of shocks at the same time, they think about financial education as a substitute for any other type of unemployment insurance or, you know, additional support for healthcare yeah. or things like that. And I think that's a tricky line.
This is so relevant right now in terms of like also the social issues that we're seeing of the day and impact and like access and people not yeah. having, I mean, that what you're saying right now to me is the argument, the blame game and the judgment for why Black people can't just like, you know, make it. I made it in my life. Why can't they just make it? Because these are like so systemic barriers to the different outcomes. So it's not really about literacy. It's about where you come from, right? What your back, like what home environment you have, what education system you went through. And then yes, literacy is important, but there are so many other systemic things. So if you don't equalize it and teach equally these things, you just continue to reinforce those barriers to an outcome totally. And access. Yeah.
Financial literacy without access is not very helpful, right? There are so many people living in communities with no low-cost banking services that really have no options. And improving access should be like separate people thinking about how to do this, move this together. Maybe this needs to be more in the fintech space. Maybe this needs to be like another way to integrate things. But I think we need to start pairing access and education.
And the high school approach, The high school approach made so much sense to me because it was a way to certainly democratize the conversation, but, you know, under like the same umbrella, like all these kids are, maybe they come from different households and they have different concerns, but they're coming from a similar day-to-day environment, in which case you should be able to streamline a curriculum. And then secondly, there are, you know, those who can and want to are about to go into college where you now have all these credit card companies targeting them because they have all of these brands on campus and they're saying, here's a t-shirt, sign up for a credit card. And all of a sudden, all these kids are not only graduating with mass student debt, but they're also graduating with mass like high interest credit card debt. And that's something that even our generation didn't really, we didn't have that on campus when I was on campus. And I think that that's a nuance to the Gen Z experience in school. But I think Erin has a follow-up and I will let her ask that before I move on.
You can see me getting excited. I think, you know, this is such a hard space because education, I think, but this is my question. I have two questions. One is, how do you really change educational structures like this? Like, is it a lobbyist? Is it at a school board level? Is it at, you know, a state level? That's one. And number two is, you know, fintech creates a really interesting opportunity, I think, for financial literacy for young people. And I think you have to do it carefully. But one thing that is that I love about what's happening in the fintech space is that it does democratize, and I put that in air quotes, access to people, no matter what their gender is, no matter what their race is. No one cares what your name is if you have a social security number and you have, you know, some sort of income setting up a bank account on a fintech. You're not going into a bank. You're not having all this, like, you know, racial stereotypes, gender stereotypes coming at you that has historically existed in the financial space. And so there's this, like, moment for me where I was like, there's, this is the time for education to embrace financial technology, to be able to optimize, especially like all the mock environments that fintech, that technology can create, where people can actually participate and see access when their parents couldn't, or, you know, their mothers didn't manage money ever, or whatever it is. Like, and I see that as like, maybe that's a pipe dream in 30 years because the education system is so heavy. But I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, so I'll start with your first question. So on the lobbying side, I would say at the federal level, to the best of my knowledge, there's nobody that's really lobbying or writing legislation in the fin ed space, the financial literacy space. And I think it's tricky because like the programs you could think about would be like more grants to schools or more funding or something like that. But there's not going to be a federal education policy just because that's not how our system works. So a lot of it happens at the state level. I think the most successful cases have come, much to my chagrin, if you will, because, you know, I think the research speaks volumes. But when they hear from young people that want these courses or who, you know, are basically begging them to teach this instead of something else.
But how sophisticated do those children need to be to lobby?
You know, some of them are good. I think in Rhode Island, all of these high school students were just reaching out via social media and just kept tagging their treasurer, their state treasurer. They just were continuously doing this. So when you get young people together, you can do really cool things, but they have to be excited about it because young people won't fake it, right? Like they're not doing it for fun. I think at the grassroots level, it's usually like teachers that are just like excited about this. Usually they got into some type of financial trouble and they're willing to just like start this up. And then there's usually some sort of a network around it. So if you map out the schools where personal finance is required, they tend to bunch in areas. So there'll be a cluster in different areas. So I think like the teachers get to know each other and then they all kind of jump in at the same time, which is kind of a cool thing think about, but you need to bring that up to a higher level to get equal access across the states. I think in terms of your question about fintech, I totally agree. And I think there needs to be a partnership earlier rather than later. I always am slightly concerned that, you know, who's going after these young people, who's targeting them, who can make a lot of money off of them. And then how much can the CFPB really be watching out for in this space?
Totally.
But I think if educators and, you know, there's a lot of nonprofits in the space that are just continuously operating in the FinEd space. And I think if they can really focus on youth and we can get the people who work in the FinTech space to talk to the people who work in the FinEd space, and they can actually start to have this nice fluid conversation, then maybe we can improve all of it together.
Introduce us. Totally. We want to talk about it. the thing that you can do, I totally hear you on being not predatory, but one of the, you know, there are a lot of regulations in the financial space about not being predatory with under 18. So like it is this moment where you can create like a hybrid or a mock or pilot environment where kids can like fake navigate these systems to see how they work with technology. And then you can, you know, you just have more access with that ability.
I think too, if you create more of a kid focused or kid like high school, whatever, teenage focused curriculum, you have opportunity to introduce these topics in much more interesting ways, maybe across different courses. So like I was speaking to a colleague of yours, Daniel, on the phone, and we were talking kind of through the same thing. And I what you were saying, that a lot of this curriculum, if it is taught, is paired with a social studies or like some specific course. Well, what happens when that kid doesn't like that class? You know, for me, like the obvious would say like, okay, you throw it into a math class. Well, I hated math in high school, you know, like what is that predisposition to not really being good at that course? How does that impact then the kids' like cognitive approach to their, how great they'll be with their financial management, you know? And I think that there's something to be said if you can try and streamline it across courses, you have a better opportunity to target as many kids across different interests as you can. I don't know what that looks like, but
it's an interesting research question. Yeah.
Have you seen, in your data, have you seen like a difference between the independent financial literacy courses versus the integrated ones? Has that shown any?
You know, this always kills me because I would love to say yes. But no.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is tricky because the independent classes haven't been around for as long. So we don't have as many years post in terms of data. But not yet.
And you really only have 5 states that you're looking, that you have the ability to. Yeah. It's so
lots of individuals within those states though. So
yeah,
big enough samples that we would be able to detect differences.
Right. We have a big enough country.
Yeah.
So
I think going back to like the FinTech versus the FinTech access and financial education, the one thing I think is important about schools is meeting people where they already are. And it's your last opportunity to really get people before they go off into a million different directions. Right. And if you know, it's easy to say like, oh, workplace financial education. Well, what if people are unemployed? Or what if people have non-traditional work? Or we have like a gig economy now and there's a lot more part-time workers? Or like, how do you actually reach people afterwards and have them in a similar life situation where they're all making similar financial decisions? High school is really the last time for that. Maybe you can argue for college, but not everyone goes to college. So it's really kind of the last opportunity to reach people where they already are.
Right. I think we could talk about this for hours. I do want to ask you a question about the people teaching or not teaching this curriculum and teachers, because I think this is a key piece of the puzzle. You know, how can we better equip those teachers to bring this education into the classroom? I feel like I hear time and time again, well, it would be great if we had that, but we can't find the teachers that want or feel confident in teaching that kind of course.
I think teacher training is super important. This is the type of course where, you know, you're just bringing in what you know already, right? About your own personal finances. And it might be really dicey for some people and really uncomfortable and stressful, even if you've had, you know, other shocks like a divorce or a death or like other financial shocks that are totally unrelated to your normal pay. But there are a lot of groups out there that are doing a ton of teacher training, mostly for free. So Federal Reserve Banks, Next Gen Personal Finance, Jumpstart Coalitions and Council on Economic Education. They do a lot of teacher training, and now it's all virtual, so it's even lower cost
more
for
accessible.
Them.
Yes,
love it.
And there's actually this really cool study out of Peru where they did a huge randomized control trial across all the schools in the country. Veronica Frigenko from the Inter-American Development Bank did this huge randomization, and they got credit scores of teachers before and after they had to teach it. And the teachers' finances improved substantially. And before, they never had to do any of this. But giving them the information at the, like, you know, the school age child, I think they were all from like 8th to 12th-ish grade, but it's not a direct translation. They needed it in that level, right? They needed it in the lower, the like kid level financial education, not the adult level that they were getting elsewhere. And it dramatically helped them. So maybe the right approach is to start doing more financial education for teachers, and then they might just take it upon themselves to start teaching it anyway.
I cannot. So is Peru, has Peru standardized that? Is that a national standard?
They were starting to do a standard, and they wanted to do the large scale experiment before they started it. So they did an extended, I want to say like a 5-year experiment, and I think
they are. And then they had good results. So maybe
they had really good results.
Yeah. We find that with our work too, that we, you know, especially in content creators, because we have a very diverse like lifestyle background perspective on, we want everyone to be able to come and talk about their money stories. So we find that when we hire people or content creators for us, that like they come in, they feel they have a, you know, a basic understanding and knowledge, but part of it is like they come in and they learn by having to think through this, by having to talk about their experiences or interviewing people who are on their money journey. You really see this like complete shift of like, I understand this. Now I'm confident in this. Like I can manage this, and I am proud of myself, and I know I can do this because I've had to learn it for some sort of other product, you know, and that makes sense for a teacher perspective too.
Well, this is why the peer-to-peer education model works so well for different topics, right? Because you're reinforcing what you've learned, and then you build that level of confidence that you know, that will stand the test of time. Yeah, to explain it for you. And I think that happens, you know, Erin and I are obviously in like the entrepreneurial world and the female entrepreneurial world. And we're in like all these groups of, you know, peer-to-peer education on how to get funding and how to handle leadership and all these things. Well, there should be courses and groups like that for younger age kids that are sharing these kinds of experience, who maybe don't feel confident in talking to their parents about it, or can't find a teacher who, you know, they are close with to have that conversation or ask those questions or help educate them. So I think it's all super interesting. Like I said, we could talk about this all day, but I want to get into our rapid fire round. Erin, any last thoughts or questions for Carly before we hop into the round?
I do. You know me. I do have one.
I know you do.
Thank you. Oh. Yeah.
Yep.
So I don't know if you've, and this might, it might be a little bit outside of your world, but there has been a lot of research out of Stanford about grit and resilience as like key, you know, Angela Duckworth, as like key characteristics to show success later in life. And we think of it as like a growth mindset, you know, abundance mindset around money. Have you seen, because I think there is this one issue of like, if you, people are starting at different places when they come to a financial literacy course, and they have, you know, parental backgrounds, they have socioeconomic backgrounds, they have all kinds of other like emotional cognitive health issues, you know, all of that coming to this conversation. So I'm wondering if you have seen anyone who has started to integrate like behavioral health conversations around money management, where you're like self-aware enough to know how you are approaching this, or is it really like one-on-one, this is how the system works?
So I have seen more of that in the adult space. There is actually a lot of work from the CFPB now in their FinEd group, where in the last decade, I guess, they've thought about the building blocks for financial capability in adulthood. And it's like what you need to learn at different ages. And like at certain ages, early ages, you're learning executive function. And then you learn like habits and norms, like things you can kind of get used to. And you can measure some of these things. And like, you know, turning off the lights is a similar habit to like getting in the habit to save energy, you know, like very basic very basic things.
Make your bed. I have an 8-year-old. Make your bed.
I can't say I do that.
No, it's really hard. Let's be honest, yeah. It's hard.
And then when you get to the teenage years, then you can start to research and make your own decisions. So there is this kind of like psychological model of like how, where you can be at different phases in your life. I'm not sure that any like direct content of courses really kind of incorporates how you're feeling about different things at different times. And that's probably something important going forward. But I know there's more of like a financial well-being scale that can, and a skill scale that shows like how confident you are in actually making decisions. And those are starting to be incorporated in research more to try to understand like how people feel about their financial situation. So maybe you want, you know, an expensive loft in Manhattan, or maybe you want chickens in the middle of nowhere in the country. And that's fine, right? You want to be able to meet your own goals and expectations, and thinking about where people are on that kind of like financial well-being scale, where they're like, you know, making ends meet normally and like month to month and year to year expectations that they can meet. How confident are you that you can meet your own financial goals, whatever they may be?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I am going to have to find that research.
I was going to say, you're going to, we'll probably be communicating with Carly quite frequently if yes. she doesn't get sick of us in the next few weeks. I was like, that scale sounds super good for, yeah, super interesting. All right. Well, I want to dive into our rapid fire round. And of course, these are kind of quick and maybe not so easy questions to get everybody thinking about their own money mindset. So Carly, first up, what money stereotypes have you had to relearn or overcome?
I feel like my job as a data person is to debunk the money stereotypes out there.
It is, yes.
Particularly the ones about millennials, since I am on the bubble of just barely being a millennial. Like, no, they're not job hoppers. Yes, they got hit really hard by the Great Recession. Moving on, yeah.
They don't all live with their parents.
No, yeah. They don't drink like 4 vanilla lattes a day.
I love that. And thank you so much for bringing
thank
that
you,
up.
Because none of us do. Thank you.
I was once asked on an investor due diligence report if I knew what a P&L was. So
oh my God.
Let's just keep that in mind. Okay. So how do you foster a healthy money mindset?
I think you have to be really forgiving of yourself, right? There are going to be times where you make better decisions than others. And I mean, especially as an economist where you're always like optimize, optimize, optimize. Like there are going to be times when you're more rational than others. And you kind of have to like, be kind to yourself, like have your general system set up so you're not setting yourself up to fail. But you know, if you overspend on a trip sometimes and then get really mad at yourself for overspending on like a stupid grocery item, like you kind of just let it go sometimes.
Totally. Less buyer's remorse. I like that.
Yeah.
And lastly, when was the last time you nabbed something financially and how did you do it?
So, I mean, I think I'd rather not talk about anything recently because I think I'm going to make some people feel really bad. But I'll go back to like 2005 when I was studying abroad in Paris and lost my wallet. And had to live on like the only cash I had, which was about like 200 euro at the time for over a month and a half. No cards, like nothing. Luckily I still had my passport. But like I think in that period where, you know, like you're living with a host family, you have no way at that time, like I could maybe wire money through some weird French bank that I didn't have access to. It was just like, okay, I need to learn how to budget. And that was like, I figured out how to have a budget so I could eat for the next like month and a half until like cards finally started to come back. It got it through the mail. But yeah, that was my biggest like financial life hurdle where I feel like it was my best learning experience. The funny thing was somebody actually found my wallet, brought it to the police station. And I got it like months later.
France?
In Paris.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I had like left it on the metro. Yeah, like months later. They sent a notification from the police to my parents' home. And then by the time my parents got it and like contacted me and I could go there, like it was obviously too late, but everything was still in there. They didn't want my American dollars because at the time they were worthless.
Oh yeah. That's hilarious. Yeah. So wait, do you remember what your biggest hack was? Like, what were you most clever around in terms of your budget?
I think it was just like shopping for food. Luckily I had like my bus pass or my metro pass for the entire 4 months I was going to be there, and I mean I walked everywhere. Yeah, I ate a lot of rice and beans, which is so Parisian, right?
No bag, baguettes. No baguettes.
I was gonna say, can you get like a cheap baguette and you know?
It's not as filling though.
Off the truck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No. Yes,
yeah, the cheese is not that cheap. Yeah, and I did get like two meals a week with my host family, so I would just gorge on those meals.
They
were like, "Who is this weird American?"
Yeah, why is she always so hungry? That's an incredible experience to have so young. Like, I think you had to lose that wallet just to be able to build those habits. That's really cool. Yeah,
totally. I think that's amazing. Well, Dr. Urban, thank you so much for joining Aaron and I on another episode of the Navit podcast. It was such a pleasure to have you on. Frankly, I think we can't wait to have you on again. So let's get that locked in the calendar if you don't mind. Yes. And for all of our listeners, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode. Care to continue the convo? You can connect with fellow navigators in the app or on our Let's Navit Facebook page. Oh, and be sure to get social with us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Let's Navit. That's LetsNavit. And finally, wherever you're listening to this podcast, it would really help us if you would take a minute to rate, review, and subscribe. That's it for today's episode. Until next time,
Let's Navit!